Hey guys, I'm Raf.
And I'm James.
On today's episode,
The Psychiatrist's Guide to
The Link Between ADHD and Internet Gaming Disorder.
I think Root is the best board game ever made. R-O-O-T, a game of woodland might and right. So Raf.
What's up?
Have you ever played a video game so much that you've thought like, maybe I've indulged a little too much?
I have.
What game would that be?
I would say it's been different games at different times, but the two that really sucked me in would be World of Warcraft and at one point Madden.
I mean, I myself dallied in World of Warcraft. I don't think as much as you, but still enough for it to have a significant impact on my life. So I feel you there. And Raf, you are a child psychiatry fellow right now.
Indeed.
And you're probably something of an ADHD expert.
I can't call myself an expert because the people who teach me, you know, my attendings are real experts.
So you're an ADHD enthusiast.
sure. I'll take that title.
Have you ever come across kids with ADHD who also had, issues playing too many games? Or have you thought that...
All the time.
You know, yeah?
All the time.
When you say all the... I'm very curious about this. When you say all the time, is this... We'll talk about rates and everything, but is this the type of thing that, like, every child psychiatrist is going to see?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think to begin with, there's already... So the baseline usage of technology with kids today is already really super high, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think you will see in most of the kids with ADHD that there's like, you know, a more intense or longer amount of time that they tend to use certain apps or games, and a certain percentage of them will do it to the exclusion of any other part of their life.
Mm.
So I have a couple of patients like that.
And have you ever thought that there might be a connection between ADHD and internet gaming disorder?
Absolutely.
Spoiler alert, there is.
What?
We're going to talk about it. And you know, what's fascinating to me is that not only is there a connection, but this is the focus of some of the newest, most fascinating, and most comprehensive neurobiological research in psychiatry.
Nice.
Is really identifying the link between these two things and showing how people at risk for one are at risk for the other, and even showing some more interesting connections that we'll get to later. But I think for our audience's sake, a good place to start is just a reminder about the two different mental illnesses and what they are and what they're not. And before we jump into definitions, which I think we should do just to cover our bases so that our audience is with us, I always just like to start with a broad overview. But since you're the expert on ADHD, maybe you want to walk us through this slide here and just give us some of the background, some important facts to know, just as a foundation on ADHD.
Sure. ADHD is a persistent pattern of inattention and or hyperactivity / impulsivity that interferes with functioning or development. It begins in childhood before the age of 12. Actually, what I'll point out about ADHD is that it fits into the category of neurodevelopmental disorder. Mm-hmm. Meaning that it's something that it happens either in utero or shortly after birth. Essentially, it's something that you're born with, right?
Definitely, you
know,
yeah.
Usually, you know, the parents of my patients who have ADHD say, yes, they've always been that way.
Sure.
And that can help differentiate it from other things that might present similarly, like bipolar disorder if they're in the middle of a hypomanic episode or,
definitely,
you know, substance abuse or something else. Mm-hmm. So that's important. So again, neurodevelopmental disorder, which also means it kind of tags along with a bunch of other neurodevelopmental disorders. Not that everyone has them, but they can tend to kind of go together if,
sure,
they share the same neurological hardware. The prevalence, some estimates are that about 5% of children have it and 2.5% of adults, which is another topic in and of itself, because, mm-hmm, the question always comes up, will they grow out of it? I'll give you the short answer, although we'll probably do an even more in-depth episode about ADHD at some point.
Yeah.
But you know what I'll say is that usually what goes away is the hyperactivity, just because if you look at kids and look at adults and just think about your own life, you know,
sure,
you're a lot more energetic and hyperactive when you're younger, even if you don't have ADHD, right? So that tends to go away, but the inattentive part doesn't, right? So, you know, there's a lot of research into those numbers and, you know, there's a lot of interesting details in there, but, you know, we'll get to it in the future. There is supposedly a male to female ratio of 2 to 1. It's a little smaller in adults of 1.6 to 1. However, I don't know if that's really the case, that boys have it twice as much. This could be, you know, kind of a sociocultural thing where girls aren't diagnosed with it.
100%. I mean, and also you have to take into consideration that probably inattentive type, I would assume that inattentive type is likely underdiagnosed in girls.
Yeah. Inattentive type is underdiagnosed in general. And I think probably girls tend to have a higher prevalence of inattentive type, but also because of kind of like social factors. If a girl is quiet or daydreaming, it'll go under the radar.
Sure.
More so than in boys. It can have a variable course. So everybody's symptomatology is different. And it has a lot of classic comorbidities, an anxiety disorder. 30% of kids with ADHD will also have an anxiety disorder. Other very common ones are oppositional defiant disorder. And that can turn into like a whole spectrum that eventually could become conduct disorder. DMDD, or disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Again, another fascinating diagnosis that we'll talk about in the future.
Yes.
A specific learning disorder. I talked about ADHD being a neurodevelopmental disorder, right? And sharing some of the neurological hardware with other aspects of learning, right? So it'll be common to have either other subtle neurological changes, like some motor delays or, you know, other things that can sometimes go under the radar, but definitely it can be associated with specific learning disorders.
Sure.
And also depression. You know, what I see a lot actually is, I think there's two ways, right? One is that sharing that neurological hardware, right? That causes these comorbidities. But the other thing that happens too, if you have untreated ADHD, is that it starts to affect the way that you interact with your environment. It starts to really be obvious when you're in grade school. Not for everyone. Some people aren't caught until much later, but you know, and classically, right? When you start to get in trouble, right?
Sure.
And you start to get labeled a bad kid, you know, if people don't understand what's going on. And if you're told that enough times, you start to internalize it. And there's no surprise that you're going to develop anxiety, low self-esteem, depression, right?
Definitely.
If it's untreated. And other things that happen in untreated ADHD, there's a much higher prevalence of substance abuse. There's a higher prevalence of head injuries, like concussions, and even a higher prevalence of motor vehicle accidents. Yeah. So if you really truly have ADHD, it's very important to treat it because it could go very poorly.
Definitely. And I feel like, you know, not only do the kids get told because of situations they get in school, like maybe they start to become the bad kid. And as you said, they internalize it.
Right.
But that's coming from like maybe the administration, principals, teachers down. But it also happens within the group of kids, right? Mm-hmm. The kid, even among the other kids, the kid becomes known as the weird one, the quirky one.
Or the class clown, or depending on, you know, how their symptoms kind of show.
Which can then have tremendous effects on that person's life down the line. You know, everything from, again, then leaning into that and internalizing that to just them feeling alone and isolated and, you know, not understanding why they're different from everyone else.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard to remember when you become an adult how little we knew as kids, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
But they have a very limited, narrow understanding of the world.
Mm-hmm. And so now that we've covered just a baseline of ADHD, just want to do the exact same thing for internet gaming disorder and just remind our audience that internet gaming disorder is a persistent and recurrent use of the internet to engage in games, often with other players, leading to clinically significant impairment or distress. Important to note, I think we've talked about this before, but important to note that unlike ADHD, which is in the first section of the DSM, the neurodevelopmental disorders, internet gaming disorder is still technically a diagnosis that requires further investigation. So it's actually in the back of the DSM. It's one of the two use disorders that's back there, the other being caffeine use disorder. So
Can we plug our book right now?
Oh, yeah. If you, I didn't even think about that. And if you're fascinated by this and you want to have a more comprehensive overview of not only internet gaming disorder, but how technology has led to perhaps a whole host of disorders, you can feel free to check out a book that Raph and I both contributed to called Technological Addictions, published by the APA. So give that a look out if you'd like. We think it's great.
Yeah, we're not going to make any money off of you buying it. So
No
financial,
absolutely not.
No financial interest, but
exactly.
Maybe an ego boost, I guess.
Sure. But getting back to internet gaming disorder. So unlike ADHD, there's no specifics mentioned in the DSM about the age of onset. IGD can be diagnosed in a child for the first time. IGD can be diagnosed in a 70-year-old person for the first time. It doesn't matter. Now, prevalence varies by region. It's currently estimated that it's highest in Asia. Much like the prevalence numbers for ADHD, these are not 100% accurate, and they should be taken with a grain of salt. There are many reasons why it might be higher in Asia right now, and a lot of it is probably due to reporting bias of some type. And another prevalence number to take with a grain of salt is the difference between males and females. So right now it's estimated 8.4% in males and 4.5% in females. It's changing rapidly, and it is probably even less true for older populations. And there is some evidence to say that depending on what types of games you're looking at, older women may have more of an issue with certain games like phone games than men might. So that's changing rapidly. But the other thing to notice about the prevalence rates is that they're almost double ADHD. When I've given this talk in the past and when I've spoken to other providers about this, they are often flummoxed by that. And the reason why is quite simple. The reason why is because every psychiatrist, every mental health practitioner has seen many patients with ADHD, and there's tons of research on it. It's something that you're taught. And when they're told that the prevalence for internet gaming disorder might be twice as high, they say, whoa, 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 pump the brakes a little bit. How could that possibly be? Because I've met plenty of patients with ADHD. I've never met a single patient with internet gaming disorder. Why? How
because
could that possibly be? And exactly. Because you didn't ask. Don't and if you don't ask, you won't know. Another smaller part of that answer might be because it's still under investigation. Our definition is still in flux. But it's not something that you were thinking about, and it's not something that you asked about. And because you didn't think about it, and because you didn't ask about it, you didn't learn about it. But if you have it in the back of your head that maybe this is something that you should be thinking about, especially when you're dealing with patients with ADHD, I bet you'll ask more about it. And I bet you'll find that a good number of those patients are spending way more hours a day playing video games than you could possibly have imagined.
Child psychiatrists would be much less surprised, I would think. I don't know whether they'd agree with the numbers or not specifically, but I think they'd be less surprised at the prevalence just because the kids' parents are always, they'll tell you whether you want to hear it or not. Like, they're always on their phone.
One thing that's really interesting, and the parents' view of internet gaming disorder is often quite different from the kids' view of internet gaming disorder. So if you ask parents, are they putting firm limits on the number of hours that their kids are playing? They'll say yes. And the kids will say absolutely not. And if you ask the parents, how many hours a day are the kids playing games? And then you ask the kids, you'll find that the parents are likely to woefully underreport. And there's good practical reasons for this, right? The parent will see the kid playing for a certain portion of the day. In this modern era, especially, video games are not tied to the television set anymore. So if the kid's playing Nintendo Switch, the parent might notice that. But if the kid's going to sleep at night and then staying up for 4 hours playing something on the phone, the parent might not see that. And the parent might not even know that that's something they should be putting limits on. So that's an important thing to note when you're talking about the differences in perception between parents and kids and this internet gaming disorder in particular. Like ADHD, it has a variable course. And like ADHD, it has various comorbidities. It is comorbid with ADHD. We know that to be true. It's also comorbid with obsessive compulsive disorder and major depressive disorder in particular, as well as anxiety disorders.
One that I think needs to be researched more is the comorbidity with social anxiety disorder. But social anxiety disorder is underdiagnosed and poorly understood to begin with. So, and also I think it would
100%
it would lead into a whole conversation about how we define internet gaming disorder, because this is in the DSM-5, right? So I think this was exploding in Asia around the time of the DSM-5, so it kind of snuck in there, but like it's way too narrow in my opinion, in the sense of like only MMORPGs on the internet are addictive, right? As opposed to like not internet games or like, how about like in other social media platforms, right?
Exactly. And that's definitely part of the reason why the definition is inadequate. But before we get there, similarities between just what we've just discussed, just kind of the broad strokes of it in terms of what's similar between ADHD and IGD on the face of it. As of right now, as of the most recent research, they both affect males more than females, but that's changing. Another similarity is that internet gaming disorder is known to be comorbid with ADHD. Both are comorbid with depression, anxiety, and both have a variable course. And Raf, did you want to go through some of the differences just based on what we just talked about?
First was the prevalence numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Internet gaming disorder might be twice as prevalent in some areas as ADHD. And the other big one is that there's no age specification in internet gaming disorder, which, by the way, you know, there's probably some politics that play into the age specification being in ADHD. I mean, for sure, it's a neurodevelopmental disorder, right? So you want to have evidence of it being there, you know, when the person was very young. But I think also it has to do with the fear of it being overdiagnosed, which would potentially lead to even more prescription of even more stimulants, which are also a widely used, a widely abused substance.
Raf, do you want to run through briefly just the criteria for ADHD?
There's two symptom categories. There's the inattentive symptoms, and then there's the hyperactive impulsive symptoms. The inattentive symptoms include not being able to pay close attention, not being able to sustain attention. The person may seem like they're not listening. They can't follow instructions. They have difficulty organizing tasks. They avoid tasks. They lose things. They're easily distracted, and they can be forgetful. That's me in a nutshell, by the way. And then the hyperactive symptoms include fidgeting, leaving your seat, running, climbing, not being able to play quietly, looking like they're run by a motor, talking excessively, blurting out answers, not being able to wait their turn, and interrupting people in conversation. Sufficient symptoms in either category or both. 6 out of 9 for kids, 5 out of 9 for adults. Yeah, so you can be diagnosed with ADHD primarily an attentive type, ADHD primarily hyperactive, impulsive type, or ADHD combined type. Some of the symptoms have to be present in at least 2 settings. And that is an important criteria, right? Because if it's only happening at home or only happening at school, then it may be an environmental factor that's influencing, right? It may be suggestive of something else going on or another diagnosis, et cetera. Because if we're saying that this is a neurodevelopmental disorder, we're saying this is the way this person's brain functions and is structured. And so it shouldn't change that much depending on the setting, right? So usually these kids will be like this everywhere.
Definitely. All right, so I'll quickly run through the actual diagnostic criteria for internet gaming disorder. The first thing to know about these criteria is A, it's under investigation still, and B, this criteria was borrowed wholesale from the only other behavioral addiction which is in the DSM proper, which is gambling disorder. And so that's one of the many reasons why this criteria is maybe not the most accurate in terms of actually looking at someone's problematic video game use. But the criteria as they stand now are you have to have a preoccupation with video games, so you have to be thinking about them more than you'd like. You have to experience withdrawal when they're taken away. And withdrawal doesn't need to necessarily be physiologic in the way that it may be with a substance use disorder, such as opiate withdrawal, but it can be emotional and it can be behavioral. You have to have experience a phenomenon that we call tolerance, and that is that you need to game more and more to get the same level of relief or enjoyment that you were able to get previously with gaming less. The next thing is that you've tried to cut down and you can't. Another thing to look out for is losing interest in other things that you used to enjoy. So for example, someone used to be an avid soccer player, they were for their whole life, and all of a sudden they're not playing anymore because they're spending too many hours a day in front of World of Warcraft and they just don't have time to play soccer anymore. Another criteria is continued use despite consequences. So, you know, maybe financial consequences. You know, a lot of these games have loot boxes now, and maybe you're in financial dire straits because of, you know, your gaming, but you keep going anyway. Another criteria is lying about your gaming to family, therapists, so on and so forth. Something else to look out for is using games to modulate your mood. So feeling like you need to relax, so you play a game. Feeling sad, you want to feel happy, so you play a game, that kind of thing. And then relationship issues, having a spouse be upset with you, having your marriage disintegrate because of internet gaming disorder. So those are the criteria as they stand. I think that this criteria as it is, it doesn't it doesn't incorporate the social impact of games, and it doesn't really address the reality of games today and their breadth and diversity. Right? It's possible to be addicted to Candy Crush, and it's possible to be addicted to World of Warcraft. And those are two very different things. Maybe they shouldn't even be the same, diagnosis. You know, that's certainly a question for another time. But the reason why we're talking about the criteria of these two things is just to point out the fact that, yes, there's a connection between these two things, but diagnostically, in terms of the criteria, literally no overlap. So there is no one symptom in the ADHD criteria that you see in the IGD criteria and vice versa. So while we're going to tease out these connections today, it's important to realize that diagnostically, they are two separate entities, one of which is very well established and one of which will probably change and evolve.
You know, I've never thought about it that clearly, like how different they are, right? Because I'm so used to thinking about similarities between them conceptually and diagnostically, right? And psychiatric diagnoses have a social cultural aspect to them. Because at some point we have to draw a line and say, this is, I don't want to say abnormal because it's not a matter of normality. It's a matter of impact on the individual's life. And you can clearly see that internet gaming disorder is being looked at from the perspective of the addiction literature, and ADHD is being looked at from a neurobiological perspective.
Definitely. I think when people think about the similarities between them, I think they are thinking of shared features of the two disorders. And they're conflating that with the diagnostic criteria, which makes sense to a certain degree. You know, patients who have both ADHD and IGD are noted in literature to be impulsive and hostile. And another connection that we've noticed is that the severity of ADHD can be correlated with the severity of internet gaming disorder. And another thing that maybe might be self-evident, especially to our child psychiatrists out there, is that hyperactive patients have more severe ADHD symptoms, at least on the face of it, like observable to anyone who's around the patient. And those hyperactive patients will also have more observable internet gaming disorder symptoms on the face of it to parents and other onlookers. And so these are just kind of some things that I think as clinicians we think about, but we have to remember that these are shared features and that the actual diagnostic criteria are quite different. But I do want to talk about treatments just briefly. And Raph, I think you are the guru. You should take this one away. Like all things in psychiatry, it should be a multimodal approach. But when you see ADHD, in addition to what's here, what do you do? What's foremost?
So interestingly, unless there's a reason not to, start a stimulant. Stimulant medication is superior to behavioral interventions. It's incredibly effective when the diagnosis is accurate. There's like an 80% response rate, you know, at least if you try one from each class. You know, sometimes you try one and it's not sufficiently effective, you switch to the other class, then usually, you know, a lot of those will respond to the second one. But it's incredibly effective and it can be life-changing. So, you know, that's my go-to. You know, it's the thing that treats the condition most directly. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other very important behavioral interventions. And of course, you know, I recommend both. So medication-wise, stimulants are the first-line medication unless there's a reason not to. Like the person has a history of an arrhythmia or sudden cardiac death, or they have a comorbid tic disorder. And they're concerned about exacerbating the tics, which is another conversation, by the way. The stimulants don't cause the tics, they just unmask them. Then, you know, if you can't use a stimulant for some reason, then there are several other classes of medication that are used, like Strattera or atomoxetine. Another good medication would be extended release alpha 2 agonists, like guanfacine or long acting clonidine or Capvay. I'll just point out that only the extended release ones are actually FDA approved, not the short acting ones. And you know, they're probably better to use anyway. And you know, another thing we often use if there's comorbid depression, you know, Wellbutrin might kind of kill two birds with one stone, right? And treat the depression and the ADHD at the same time.
Sure.
Absolutely would recommend behavioral interventions. So the classic behavioral techniques include positive and negative reinforcement, and punishment, right? Positive and negative punishment. The most effective technique is positive reinforcement, beyond the shadow of a doubt. Punishment I would use very sparingly, but the most powerful thing you can do to shape a kid's behavior is to catch them doing the right thing and reinforce them positively in that moment. But it requires you to understand what is actually reinforcing for the kid, right? And that can get very difficult to truly understand the effects of what you're doing. But definitely, and by the way, the most powerful type of positive reinforcement is the undivided attention of the caregiver. So, you know, doing what they want to do for an extended period of time and just purely paying attention to them. Timeout is a very useful technique. Definitely a token economy can be extremely useful. You know, basically you can think of it as like a behavioral chart, right? Where there'll be a list of certain behaviors that you want the person to engage in or not engage in. And they can earn stars, right? Or tokens for engaging in the behavior. And then maybe like at the end of the week, they can use those tokens to then get a prize of some sort that would be a further reinforcer. So all of these things are very variable for each individual. Definitely they vary by age, right? So for example, like a timeout, you want to do at most like a minute per year. But then on top of that, if the person has ADHD, they already have a shorter attention span and more impulsivity to begin with. And so, you know, it has to be shorter intervals for all of these things. And you want to have a behavioral chart. You want to have a token economy where, first of all, the kid's got to buy into it, right? It's got to be like a deal that they agree to beforehand. And it's got to be set up in a way where they can win more often than they lose, right? Because usually what happens is the parent will set up this chart of like, you need to do this, 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 and this, and you'll get a star and you'll get a thing. But the kid just can't do it, right? And then how long do you think it's going to be before they say, forget it, I'm not doing this, right? They give up in like 2 days, right? You got to just kind of like move the needle, right? So you're not turning a speedboat, you're steering a cruise ship. So you want to set it up in a way that they'll keep winning and winning and winning. And then you can kind of game it that way. Pun intended, by the way.
Gotcha.
There are psychotherapeutic techniques like CBT. It depends on the age and the, you know, the cognitive ability of the kid, right? The younger they are, the more purely behavioral techniques you'll need to use versus starting to include some kind of cognitive techniques like CBT, right? And other forms of psychotherapy can be used, right? Because there's also the aspects of like the low self-esteem and all sorts of things that can be approached with different techniques. And if you recall, we covered on another episode that there's actually a video game itself that's FDA approved for the treatment of ADHD, Endeavor RX. So check out the episode on Endeavor RX to learn more about that.
All right. And just briefly, you know, I do want to talk about the treatments with internet gaming disorder, because I think this is the first hint that there may be a much deeper connection between these two disorders.
That looks like Prozac.
You know,
James put a picture on the screen trying to be clever with a medication, but it looks suspiciously like off-brand Prozac to me.
Oh, man. I should change it to actually one of these meds that we're talking about here. But it's important to know that there are pharmacologic interventions that have been studied for internet gaming disorder and have been found to be effective. They're not nearly as well researched, and there's not nearly as much evidence as there is for ADHD, but there's enough evidence, and enough of it is quite promising, that I think that you shouldn't hesitate, should you find yourself treating someone with internet gaming disorder, from considering one of the interventions I'm about to discuss. The first thing to know is that, like ADHD, internet gaming disorder can be treated with CBT on its own. There are specific versions of CBT for technology and for addiction, such as CBT for internet addiction specifically, but studies have shown that CBT alone and CBT for internet addiction are equally efficacious when it comes to internet gaming disorder. But I think the intervention that has been studied the most and been found to be the most successful early on are bupropion and methylphenidate and atomoxetine.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, sounds familiar, right? It's what we should be using to treat ADHD, especially when it comes to the stimulants. And I think that in the research, the two biggest ones are really methylphenidate and bupropion, and they're both very promising. So I think when I was looking into this subject for the first time, you know, that really tipped me off that there might be a connection here. Now, this delves into something that we're not going to talk about today called psychopharmacologic determinism, which is a philosophical point of view that has points for it and points against it. What I'm just going to say a brief definition of that now, and we can talk about it later. Psychopharmacologic determination is the idea that you can take a treatment response and work backwards from that as either evidence of a diagnosis or evidence of some underlying pathology. A more concrete example of that would be having someone come into the emergency room, having them appear psychotic, giving them an antipsychotic, watching them improve, and then, based on that outcome, working backwards and saying, okay, because this person responded to an antipsychotic, or I believe that is further evidence of the fact that they have a psychotic disorder. In some ways, that seems very self-evident. But in other ways, right, that's extremely problematic. And I have complicated views about psychopharmacologic determinism. On the whole, I think it's probably a horrible idea. And yet it's something that psychiatrists do all the time, even subconsciously. Yes, when I approached the subject, I was using that idea as a framework to connect the two disorders.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it shouldn't stop there.
It's a piece of evidence, right? But only a piece, you know, a small piece. Yeah.
Exactly.
If you use it that way, I think it's useful.
I think the real work comes after you make that initial observation. And that's really what we're here to discuss. And I think that's the most exciting thing about what we're talking about today. And the reason why it's exciting is because there is a huge body of literature showing that there are extensive, reproducible neurobiological correlates between internet gaming disorder and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The first thing that kind of floored me when I started looking into this was the quality of the research and the extent of the research and the recency of the research. These are big quality studies that have been done in the last few years. And they're looking at brains of people with ADHD, they're looking at brains of people who qualify for an internet gaming disorder, and they're seeing what connections are there. There's a couple studies that I want to talk about. We're going to talk about this in really basic terms because you don't need to go too in-depth to get the most important takeaways from it. But suffice it to say that I'm going to mention some of these studies. If you're interested, look them up on PubMed, dive deeper because there's a lot there. Lo and behold, they found the same brain regions are implicated in both disorders. What they found specifically was that in both ADHD and internet gaming disorder, if they were untreated, there was a decrease in connection between more frontal and superficial areas of the brain that have to deal with executive functioning and deeper areas of the brain that have to do with motor responses. Now, with ADHD, that probably makes a lot of sense for many of our practicing audience members, right? We know that ADHD is an inability of your higher level executive functioning to tamp down on those impulses to get out of your seat, to blurt out answers, everything that we discussed before. So that makes a lot of sense. And the areas in particular that we're talking about are the connections between the middle frontal gyrus, the cingulate gyrus, and then deeper structures in the brain like the caudate and the thalamus. What's surprising is that in internet gaming disorder, it's very much the same thing. Again, there's a decrease in connection between these frontal higher order regions, such as the middle frontal gyrus and the cingulate gyrus, and deeper regions like the caudate, which cause you to actually go pick up that controller and play that game. When you say it, it just makes sense. But I'm just really happy that there is so much evidence out there showing these connections, because it really highlights that these two disorders, which diagnostically, in terms of the criteria, don't have anything in common, actually have a lot in common when it comes to the neurobiology. The most fascinating thing, and really the finding that led me to look into this further in the first place, and the finding that I think is the most important for not only practicing mental health providers to know, but also just, you know, the general public, is that if you treat one, you're treating the other. So if you treat ADHD with, for example, a stimulant, you are increasing the connections between those frontal, more superficial regions, such as the middle frontal gyrus, with those deeper regions, such as the caudate and the lentiform nucleus. And by increasing those connections, by using a stimulant, by using atomoxetine, by using CBT, you're not only treating those symptoms, but you're putting that person's brain in a position where, you know, it's going to be able to self-regulate in a better way, you know? So we see that with the treatment of
That's
ADHD.
Amazing.
But you also see that since the brain regions are the same, in effect, you're treating internet gaming disorder as well. And we do indeed see that if you treat internet gaming disorder with a stimulant or bupropion or CBT, again, you're increasing the connections between the middle frontal gyrus and deeper regions like caudate and thalamus, so on and so forth. The best part about this, though, is, you know, we started this discussion by saying that internet gaming disorder might be twice as prevalent as ADHD, and we talked about how that might be because it's just not something that we're screening for. The great news is, even if you're not screening for it, if you find ADHD and you treat the ADHD, in effect, you're treating the internet gaming disorder too. Not only on a symptomatic level, but on a neurobiological level. If you treat ADHD, you are treating internet gaming disorder. The same goes for the reverse. And I think that this is the most important takeaway because it goes back to something you said, Raph, which is that yes, stimulants can be abused, but if the diagnosis is strong and you start a stimulant, you can really change someone's life. You can really change their life for the better. And I think this is just more evidence that, you know, not only can you change someone's life with regards to their ADHD, but you can also change someone's life with regards to their internet gaming disorder and vice versa. So that's why I think this is like an important thing to discuss. That's why I think all of this new research is so fascinating. And I think our takeaways should be that, you know, everything we prescribe can be misused, you know, but we have to remember the good that we can do. And we have to remember that we can really be turning someone's life around if we have the chutzpah to...
Yeah. And the cool thing about ADHD, and I suspect it's probably similar with internet gaming disorder, is it's one of those things that you can see turn around very quickly. Some aspects of it are going to take a little time to iron out, but ADHD is like, I'll never forget the first time on the child unit, you know, where I saw a kid just running all over the place, running into the walls, you know, could not stay in one place. And we gave him a stimulant for the first time. And 5 to 10 minutes later, he was calm. That, you know, that it's amazing. One thing to like know the diagnosis in the book and kind of be aware of it and having seen patients who've been on it and stuff like that. But when you see that, right, like you're the first person to diagnose it, you're the first person to treat it, and you see it work in 5 minutes, it solidifies the understanding, you know, that this is not a made up thing, right? That this is like a legitimate neurological disorder. And stimulants can work very quickly, you know, and within weeks of starting stimulants on kids, you know, we often have the parents thanking us saying, wow, what a change, right? Which isn't always the case. Some things take much longer to show themselves. So I would imagine that with internet gaming disorder, it's probably very similar, that some aspects of it may take longer, but that there might be a quick turnaround that could really, really change the course of somebody's life.
Another thing that we know, the earlier you do it and the earlier the treat, the better the outcomes are.
Your brain gets good at doing whatever it's doing, you know? It's wired in the certain way, in the way that it's of untreated ADHD or untreated IGD. It's going to continue to strengthen the connections it has and lose the connections that are weak. It's just going to get more and more ingrained, and your brain's going to slowly become less plastic over time. So that's the beauty of catching it early and the beauty of child psychiatry, right? Is you can intervene early, you know, when you have even more of a chance. But it's never too late. The brain
definitely
is always in a state of remodeling itself. It gets good at doing whatever it's doing. And we have medications and therapeutic techniques and lifestyle changes that can help you train and rewire your brain the way that you want it to be, right? So that you can live the life that you want.
Definitely. So we're not going to do a top five today because this is a little bit of a hybrid topic. But we do want to leave you with the takeaway message. And that is, if you're a provider and you're seeing ADHD, ask about internet gaming disorder. And if you're seeing internet gaming disorder, ask about ADHD. Have a low threshold to treat either because you're really going to be helping someone out. And for our listeners out there who aren't providers, for our listeners out there who may be thinking they're struggling with ADHD or thinking that they're struggling with internet gaming disorder, it's never too late to get help. And as we've explained, when you do get it, it can make a big difference, and it can make a big difference fast. So don't be afraid to get out there and ask for help and, put yourself on a better path. I think that's what our takeaway would be. If you want to learn more about
technological addictions, please check out our book published by the American Psychiatric Association called
Technological Addictions. We'd like to sign off as always by reminding our listeners that if you need help, it is out there, and we definitely encourage you to seek it out. You do not have to suffer alone. There are a huge number of mental health professionals in this country who would be happy to help, whether it's depression, anxiety, negative thoughts, negative self-image, addiction, you know, whatever you might be going through, there's someone out there who can and wants to help. You can find them in a variety of ways. You can find them using your own health insurance if you happen to have it. You can find them using resources at university hospitals that usually have free or low-cost mental health services. You can also use Psychology Today or other publications like that. And we really would just encourage you, if you're suffering, to reach out and get some help.
And remember, mental health issues, they're not a sign of weakness, they're not moral failings, they're medical conditions that can be treated. All right, I think that's it, James. So until next time.
Adios.
Peace.